Celebrated film historian and author of the new Biographical Dictionary of Film, David Thompson, is our guest. He has just written a new book, which is an account of sexuality in the movies and how actors and actresses on screen have fed our desire. The name of the book is Sleeping with Strangers, How the Movies Shaped Desire. It is part movie-going memoir and part deeply informed film history about the movies and how they have affected our ideas about love and sex. David Thompson, again, is the author of Sleeping with Strangers, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of how the book came about, of how it initially got started for you, because my understanding is that you wrote this well before Me Too, and then you look to go further than where you were initially.
Well, that's all true. The book actually began between 3 and 4 years ago, and it was to be a book about sexual desire as treated in the movies and about the way in which the movies had influenced our sense of desire and the way we feel about love and romance and sex and so on. And then I had finished a first draft before the fall of 2017, when really the whole Me Too moment broke, and you know, it was a very big dramatic change. It clearly, my book was still some way from being published. I had a first draft, but I knew that it needed more work. And so the impetus of what was happening in the world certainly affected the rewriting of the book and the sort of bringing it up to date to make it as cogent as it could be for its publication, which turned out to be February 2019.
You write an entire chapter in the book called Burning Man to your personal relationship to James Toback, who was, of course, accused in the Me Too movement. You write in the book that the Los Angeles Times had run a story claiming that Toback, one of my best friends, you write, had sexually harassed or inappropriately approached 38 women with suggestions that he might put them in a movie in return for sexual favors. Within 48 hours, that figure had reached more than 200. Jim had never been as famous before. What went into your decision to explore that relationship, that personal relationship?
I had the feeling that here was someone I knew quite well, had known him for a long time, admired a great deal about him, and yet he was in a position which I think was not entirely uncommon in Hollywood, and he was being accused of using his position as a filmmaker to intimidate and harass women. And I thought that that case study was so pressing, and I knew enough about him that it was important to write about, because I think that we have to face the fact that American movies particularly have been dominated by what I will call the male gaze. They are about male fantasy. And over the decades, they have produced some extraordinary, beautiful, and very entertaining work. But I do think that they have led to a certain attitude about male superiority that we really need to question and explore.
Did he know that you were going to write about him?
He saw the draft of what I had written well before the book came out. He saw a draft, as I recollect, in early 2018, and he made a lot of comments about it, and I made some changes because of those comments. And I'm not saying he's happy with what there is in print. I think he would rather it was not there. But it was not that he was unaware of it in any way at all, and he did have a chance to comment on it.
Give us an idea of how you believe that story and stories from other members of his generation, what they can tell us about Hollywood, what they can tell us about figures, and ultimately how it goes with what you write about in the book of how the movies shape desire.
Well, I mean, it's part of what I'm talking about in terms of the male gaze. A lot of films were totally dominated by male decisions. The business was owned by men. The people who worked in the business, who made the really creative decisions, were men. And there was the assumption, although it was false, that the audience was predominantly male. That wasn't true, in fact. But the films that we produced were glorifications of male accomplishment, male ego, male decision-making. And I think that they are very much bound up in the way women, not just in American culture, it's an international thing, but the way in which women were subordinated. And I think the cultural problems that we have come to because of that. I mean, I think we are clearly enduring a very, very old-fashioned male supremacy attitude in Washington, D.C., and in the occupant of the White House. And I think we're suffering terribly from it. And I talk in the book about how there being a kind of incipient cultural civil war in America in terms of attitudes to many things, race as well as sexuality, poverty, wealth, all those things. They're all bound up together. But I think that Hollywood, in telling us that essentially white males could run the world, could run the family, and that they were so accomplished, they were so successful, they were, in other words, great, that they became figures that we were supposed to worship and follow and try to copy. Well, the truth is that white males make as many mistakes as any other kind of person. And I think it's very painful for America particularly to come to terms with that. And I'm talking about something that affects the movies, but it's in TV, it's in commercials, it's all through our culture. And much as I love the accomplishments and the achievements of the Hollywood movie, I think that they deserve close scrutiny and examination at the moment.
You talk about this, but what do you think, if we know this better, if we have a greater understanding of Hollywood's history of exploitation and yes. and what you refer to as the male gaze, G-A-Z-E, we should note, what they do for the industry as it moves forward. You have great skepticism when we talk about the industry and if it believes it has anything like the impact on culture that it once had.
Well, the movies were once upon a time the dominant form of entertainment for the population across the world. Essentially, through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, certainly into the middle, late 40s, everybody went to the movies, and there was a feeling that everyone knew the same films. People watched the movies in packed theaters, large theaters, and there was a great sense of community and a shared response to those movies. That has broken down, and we now use our screens in so many different ways. And I think what that's leading to is a far greater range and richness of movies, or not even always movies, the kind of things we're watching on long-form television. You saw at the Oscars, there were hardly any mainstream Hollywood films up for contention. The films that are really interesting, people, are films made independently. They're difficult films very often. They're frequently films that put up a kind of stress and emphasis on people of color, on women, that really was not the case if you go back 15, 20 years ago. The world of filmmaking has changed, and I think that's all for the better. And we're getting much more challenging films. The kind of stereotypes that I see embodied in that slogan, Make America Great Again, they're really coming under question. And for the sake and health of this country and for the world, we have to pursue that questioning.
How do you feel about the controversy over Green Book winning Best Picture, in the sense that many say that this is a film that doesn't have the best of intentions when in its exploration of this country's racial history?
Well, I think considering the range of films that were available this year, I sort of share Spike Lee's dismay that Green Book won, because Green Book is really a feel-good film about race. It says to us, it's going to be okay. These two guys get along. They really understand each other. Well, I'm afraid to say that if you look at the newspapers, if you look at what is actually happening in this country, there isn't nearly enough evidence that we are going to be okay in a racial sense, or that people are getting on. We still have the problems we had in the 1950s and 60s when we hoped civil rights legislation was going to solve the problem. There's a great, great deal of trouble still over race. And I think Green Book reflects the old, somewhat middle-aged, elderly, white part of the Academy that wants to feel good and which once voted Driving Miss Daisy as the best film, a decision that in hindsight looks really pretty shaming, I think. And in my opinion, as the years go by, Green Book, which is a very entertaining film, very well done, has a lot of virtues and assets, but I think the decision that it was the best film of this year will not do us too much credit down the road.
The idea of how movies shape desire, and in this book you have chapters on well-known sex symbols. They look on the careers of people such as Cary Grant and Jean Harlow and Rudolph Valentino. How do those early figures in film really set the tone when it comes to that idea of desire in film?
Well, just to take a couple of them quickly, Valentino was one of the first great sexually charismatic figures on the screen. And almost immediately when he came to power, and he had a fairly short reign because he died so young, but almost immediately there were suspicions in, let's say, conservative America, that he wasn't quite as virile, quite as manly as they would want him to be, that perhaps he was gay, or simply less than manly. Well, I think historically, one of the great things the movies did, and Cary Grant is perhaps the outstanding example, is to introduce to us lead actors who were a little more complicated than, let us say, the John Wayne stereotype. And I think that if you go back to the 1950s, say, Rock Hudson for several years was the number one box office attraction. Everyone believed And I mean, really, everyone in the audience believed that he was authentically male as that very fabricated name, Rock Hudson. We learned not long thereafter that his actual sex life was much, much more complicated. It was a life that he was not able to own up to on screen. He was not able to play the kind of person he really was. I think if you look at the history of the medium, we've done very well at providing sexually ambiguous figures on screen. Grant, I think, is the most obvious of them all. But we're very bad at recognizing and admitting it straight away. Whereas I think if you look at what's happening in the country as a whole, we're getting into a period where an increasing number of people don't simply settle for one gender attitude. Life is much more complicated, and we need movies that deal with that instead of simply plugging the advertised role model stereotype of how a man should be and how a woman should be. For so long, women on screen just had to be sexy. They had to be worthy of the male gaze. In real life, the relationships between men and women are so much more complicated than that.
The name of the book is Sleeping with Strangers, How the Movies Shaped Desire. David Thompson is the author. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. David Thompson is the author of Sleeping with Strangers, How the Movies Shaped Desire. The book is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.